This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most economic indicators are up. An end-of-the-year rally on the stock market is credited to a rosy outlook for 2004, but too many American families are being overwhelmed by debt. Today, we're going to focus on some of the overlooked economic indicators: mortgage foreclosures, auto repos, mobile home delinquencies, maxed-out credit cards, and the ultimate act of economic despair, bankruptcy. If your family's going through an economic crisis, give us a phone call. How are you handling it? The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll try to get an idea of how last week's earthquake in Iran will reverberate by finding out what's happened in the 15 years since a trembler shook down much of the Armenian city of Spitak. First, though, household debt. In a few minutes, we'll talk with bankruptcy expert Elizabeth Warren about how bankruptcy's become a middle-class issue and what to do about it. But first, some of those less rosy indicators from Dean Baker at the Center for Economic Policy Research. He joins us from his home here in Washington, D.C. Good to have you on the program. Dean, the economy is showing some signs of recovery, but what about Americans' debt levels? What are those?
Well, they've really been rising very, very rapidly, and you find a lot of levels, a lot of indications of distress in a variety of measures, and certainly grounds for concern about the year going forward in terms of people meeting up their monthly payments.
Well, what about, are there numbers on debt levels? Any way to calculate it?
Yeah, there's lots of different measures. I mean, one of the things, just the most basic level, the debt service ratio is at an all-time high. It's at 13.3%, meaning that 13.3 cents of every dollar of people's income is committed to debt. It had never been that high. The previous record was just 12.5 cents back in 86. People have been acquiring debt at a very, very rapid rate. I should also point out, our numbers lag here a bit, so I'm referring to numbers that are at the end of the second quarter of this year, and the reason why that's important is because people borrowed like crazy in the third quarter. Much of the big growth that we saw in the third quarter was due to a huge wave of mortgage refinancing. People took that money, they spent it, they bought new cars with it, they went on vacations, but long and short, they added to their debt, and we don't yet have those numbers incorporated in much of our data yet.
Well, given the data that you do have, what about those mortgages? Are Americans able to stay on top of their mortgage payments?
Well, we have a very high foreclosure rate. The mortgage foreclosure rate is 1.12%. That means, you know, for every 100 homes, more than one of them is in foreclosure, and a scary statistic is that the rate of foreclosures actually increased in the third quarter. So again, we heard a lot of trumpeting of the very strong growth in the third quarter, but the rate of mortgage foreclosure, the number of homes that actually went into foreclosure, increased from 0.32% to 0.38%. And I realize that may sound like a very small number, but the point is, you know, this is really an act of desperation. You know, people do just about anything they can to avoid having their home go into foreclosure. And yet we had a lot of people, more in the third quarter than the second quarter, forced to have their home go into foreclosure.
As you say, reneging on your mortgage is the last thing you want to do. But what about, does that suggest that other kinds of loans, like car loans and mobile homes, that they would sacrifice those first?
Yeah, well, we're finding that across the board, the rate of leasing delinquencies, so people who have car loans, car leases, I should say, that's at a near record high, higher than at almost any point in the 1991 recession. Even though it's down a little bit from 2002 and earlier in 2003, mobile homes, other types of credit, consumer credit, credit card debt, credit card delinquencies were at 5.2%, higher again than at any point in the 1991 recession, down a little bit from their peaks. These numbers that we look at are down a little bit from the peaks in 2001, 2002, but they're still at very, very high levels, much worse than they were in the last recession. So pretty much across the board, it looks like people are having a very hard time paying the bills.
And as you just suggested, a lot of their credit cards are maxed out.
Well, their credit cards are maxed out, and some of the things that I look at, we have over a quarter, about 26% of the new mortgage loans that have been issued are now adjustable rate mortgages, and I'm willing to bet a lot of money those interest rates are not going down, they're going up. Mm-hmm. So when you have someone who has trouble meeting their mortgage payment now, and let's say they're at the beginning of an adjustable rate mortgage, and next year, the year after, they're going to be paying a higher interest rate in all probability, there's a lot to worry about there.
Who is affected by this? Who is the group demographically who is, having problems with their mortgages and their credit card debt and their car getting repossessed?
Well, this is pretty much across the board. I mean, you have very, very high-end people, you know, those who have done best in the last two decades and got the benefit of the tax cuts. Those people, you know, Bill Gates, I don't think will be defaulting on his mortgage. But really, up and down the income ladder, you have a lot of people that are getting very heavily indebted. And, you know, pretty much anywhere you look, you're going to find that people are really strained. And, you know, as I say, it's likely to get worse before it gets better because, you know, two things I point to. One is that interest rates are much more likely to go up than go down. I don't know anyone who differs with that view. And another issue I'm sure you don't want to get into here, but, you know, I think we have a very seriously overvalued housing market. And that, again, is going to create a lot of problems for a lot of people.
If and when.
If and when, yes.
Dean Baker, that's another subject for another day, but thanks very much for being with us today.
Sure, thanks for having me on.
Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic Policy Research, a nonpartisan economic think tank here in Washington, D.C. And joining us now, as promised, Elizabeth Warren, a professor of bankruptcy law at Harvard Law School, the author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. She's with us from Pacific Palisades in California. It's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's start with some numbers. We just heard some of those economic indicators from Dean Baker, but you say in your book a child is more likely to go through their parents' bankruptcy than their parents' divorce.
That's exactly right. That's how widespread economic distress has become in America today. More children this year have lived through their parents' bankruptcy than their parents' divorce.
Now, divorce rates, this is for marriages over a long period of time, it's roughly 50%.
That's right. But, of course, during the years that you have children, it's not as high. But the real point is more children. There will be about 1.5 million children this year who are going to live through their parents' divorce. Minor children who are at home, through their parents' bankruptcy, mm-hmm. and only about 1 million through their parents' divorce. I mean, the difference is actually big here. It's a big leap on those who are living in families that are in complete economic meltdown. That is, families who are facing home mortgage foreclosure, mamas who are parking the cars three blocks away in the hopes that the repo guy can't find it, seven-year-olds and eight-year-olds who are dealing with debt collectors on the telephone. I want to make this as real as I can. These are kids who are living through a crisis in their families, and the crisis is not that they've always been poor, or the crisis is not that daddy's moving out. The crisis is these families can't make it to the end of the month. They can't buy food and pay the mortgage and pay for the health insurance.
And am I wrong in thinking that these two things, may be some certain overlap after dad has left, single mom's going to have terrible problems.
In fact, what we found is that while children are the single best predictor today that a family will end up in bankruptcy, and that's hitting all families, two-parent and one-parent, it's the one-parent families that are really laid low. The increase in the rate of bankruptcy filing for single moms over the last 20 years has been more than 700%. And, you know, you stop and think about that. Women today are more able to earn independently. More of them are participating in the workforce. They have better educations than ever before. Their wages haven't reached that of men, but they're certainly higher than they were 20 years ago. And yet they are 700% more likely to file for bankruptcy if they have children at home than they were a generation ago. In other words, it's sort of the heart of the middle class that's in trouble here. It's moms trying to raise kids after a divorce. It's moms and dads still trying to raise kids when they lose jobs, when somebody gets sick. Those are the families who are filing for bankruptcy.
We want to hear from you on this. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Mark, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It's interesting to listen to Ms. Warren talk about families and single mothers. I'm a single person. I'm unmarried, no children. And I've been hit as well, and I think in terms of my suffering, if we want to call it that, it's been the unemployment situation. I haven't had a full-time job for 2 years, and I am now considering bankruptcy as an option. Can we talk a little bit about the first steps of bankruptcy and where I want to go from here, I guess, now that I've decided that I want to try it?
Mark, we sure can. Let me just say two things about your situation. The first is, you're not alone. I focused on families with children, but But to look at it a different way, understand about the jobs, the number one reason that people file for bankruptcy, the number one triggering event, is a job loss. More than 2 out of every 3 people who files for bankruptcy has had a significant period of unemployment before they file. Families today and single individuals like yourself are budgeted out to the edge, and it's hard to withstand a month or two of unemployment. 2 years without a full-time job, it's not surprising that you are in serious financial trouble. So that's number one. Now I'm going to tell you number two. You may be thinking about bankruptcy, but I got to tell you, this isn't the right time, Mark. The right time to file for bankruptcy is when the problem is behind you. Bankruptcy is about yesterday. It deals with yesterday's debts. It does not fix tomorrow's problems. So once you have a job and you're ready to get back on your feet, that's when you take the big assessment. You add up the debt, you look at what your income projections are, and then you make the decision about bankruptcy. You have to think of bankruptcy as a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card. And once you take it, you can't take it again. And so what that means is, Mark, you got to know you hit rock bottom. And if you're still unemployed, you can't be sure that you're not going lower yet. I'm sorry to lay that on you.
Wow. Yeah, that's not very, that's pretty bleak.
Nope, but it means, fella, bankruptcy is when you, it's part of the solution, it's part of the turnaround, but only once your overall economic horizon looks good again. So all I can say to you now, fellas, hang on.
Just wait to bounce off rock bottom, yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, I was just saying, hang on, when you get a job and you really feel like things have begun to turn around, then's the time you and I should have the conversation about bankruptcy.
Wow, anything I can do about minimum payments? I mean, which I'm not able to make on my credit card.
All your credit card companies. Don't hide out, because it's not going to do you any good. Call them, tell them where you are, and that's the best you can do. And I got to tell you this, don't let them drive you crazy on the telephone. The most aggressive creditors are not your friends. They're the ones who will call all the time. Tell them, I'm out of work, I've done the best I can, I've called you, I've told you what my circumstances are, and turn off the phone, Mark.
The phone company may want to do that for you.
I'm afraid that may be the case.
Hope that doesn't come to that.
Mark, good luck.
Bless your heart.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Let's go to another caller, and this is Faith, who's with us from Gainesville, Florida.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I lost my well-paying job after 9/11, like a whole lot of other folks. And my husband and I had a big house with a big mortgage payment with a big utility bill, and we sold it last year, about 6 months ago, actually, to get out from under the huge mortgage payment and the utility bill we couldn't afford anymore. We're now living in a rented double wide out in the country. I have sent out over 50 resumes in my area, and I have finally secured a part-time job that gives me 12 hours a week at $8 an hour, and we are just getting by. We avoided bankruptcy and foreclosure on the house by a month. And now I'm listening to this about bankruptcy, and I'm wondering, with what we have left in the credit card debt, would it be a wise thing to go ahead and do that while we're renting and there's nothing left to take?
No, Faith. I'm going to give the same advice I gave to Mark. Wait until your economic situation gets better stabilized. One of you could get sick.
Actually, my husband's job may be in jeopardy.
Faith, I hate to say this. Things could get worse. Keep bankruptcy as in your back pocket. Keep it as your get-out-of-jail-free card. Right. You could end up needing it even worse in the future.
We managed to cut our monthly expenses by about $800.
Yep.
So we're making double-up payments on what we have in credit card debt.
Faith, we're running out of time in let me put you on hold. We'll bring you back on the other side, okay?
Okay, thanks.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation with Elizabeth Warren about bankruptcy and American families overwhelmed by debt. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about middle-class incomes, spending, and increasing rates of bankruptcy. If you have questions or a story to tell, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest is Elizabeth Warren, the author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broken. Before the break, Faith was on the line with us from Gainesville, Florida. And I didn't mean to cut you off, Faith. Go ahead with your question.
That's fine. Well, the other thing I wanted to find out about, in terms of saving bankruptcy, it's my understanding that the Bush administration wanted to change the bankruptcy laws so that people that were in my situation would find it more difficult.
Yes, ma'am, Faith. The Bush administration, and I have to say, every single Republican in Congress and many of the Democrats in Congress have supported legislation that would give you less protection, make it more expensive for you to go into bankruptcy, and in many cases deny you even the opportunity to go into bankruptcy. Now, you can guess who's been lobbying for that bill. It's been the credit card companies.
Oh, yes.
They've made big campaign contributions. And beyond the campaign contributions, they send a zillion lobbyists, and I just don't know any other way to say it, to call on every senator and every congressman and on President Bush to push for legislation that would put more money into the hands of the credit card companies and the subprime mortgage lenders who are refinancing and the so-called payday lenders, putting more money into their pockets and draining it out of the pockets of families who are in financial trouble.
That is exactly how we feel. We feel like there's 10,000 people with their hand in our pocket trying to keep us from paying our rent.
Yep. And the problem is, bankruptcy is not something that should be taken lightly. It's not something that families should do quickly. But it's there for families like you. You know, we don't offer a lot in the United States in the way of real protection for jobs. We don't offer a lot in the way of a big bonus for unemployment insurance that goes on for months and even years if you don't find another job. We don't offer universal health insurance. Bankruptcy,
the part-time job I currently have, all that covers is my co-pays on my husband's medical insurance.
Yes, ma'am, I understand. Bankruptcy is, in effect, the last insurance card for the middle class. It's the last way to deal with those debts that you run up when you're unemployed, the debts mm-hmm. you run up when you have a health problem. And right now, there's a big push in Washington to take that last piece of protection away from families. And I've got to tell you, I'm glad you raised it, Faith, because it's one of those things that doesn't even make it into the newspapers. You know?
No, it doesn't.
Because
somebody locally has a sign that says, file your bankruptcy before they change the law.
Yeah, that's a really scary thought. Well, I will say, there are some people out there who fought it. You know, the bill has been pending now for 6 years. And every time it hangs by a little thread, and it one time didn't pass the House, one time didn't pass the Senate. President Clinton vetoed it as his last presidential veto. And right now it has passed the House again and is sitting there on the agenda for the Senate. So, you know, this is one of those times to think about being politically active. Call your senator over this one. Call your representative over this one. Send an email if you're one of those computer folks. Send a letter and say, that's a piece of protection for middle-class families, for folks who are down on their luck and have had a hard time. Let us hang on to this last little shred of what keeps us from having to pay debts for the rest of our natural lives.
Faith, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much. I'll finish up listening to the program.
I appreciate that, too. And I just wanted to say, obviously, the credit card industry is not the only industry in Washington that sends a lot of lobbyists to advance its cause as it sees it, and I'm sure there are arguments on the other side, which we may get to, Elizabeth Warren, but let's leave that for another program for another day and get another listener in the line, and that's Nicholas, who's with us from Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a kind of a comment / question. I notice when I hear these programs a lot of times talking about bankruptcy and debt, a lot of the focus is on joblessness and on health problems, but what I don't hear a lot of is the issue that Americans today really take out way more debt than they probably should. I mean, I'm a 29-year-old, I've got a job, and I've got good health, but I also live in a modest-sized home that I purchased, and it was not outside of my budget. I don't have credit card debt. I pay down my debt every month, and I'm careful with my money. I notice a lot of people driving in big, fancy cars, living in houses that are a lot bigger than they should be, and they just take out a lot of debt that they shouldn't have. And I wonder if you could discuss that a little bit.
Elizabeth Warren, how much of this is due to consumer exuberance?
Well, you know, Nicholas, I wish that what the data showed is that you were right and that the problem for families who are in real financial collapse is that they've just overspent. Unfortunately, that's not actually what the data show. We actually got the unpublished government data, got some data on, let's just take the typical median earning family, a mom, dad, and two kids. And let's look at that family back in the early 1970s and that same mom, dad, and two kids today. It turns out that today they make 75% more money than they did a generation ago because they've got two people at work, and a generation ago the median family only had one, but they're not making it. So where are they spending their money? Bankruptcies are up, mortgage foreclosures are up. Are they spending it on too much stuff? Well, let's start with clothing. You know, I think about all those people at the mall. I can't get a parking place. I see all those little kids wearing designer outfits. I hear about sneakers that cost $200. Do you know what today's mom, dad, and two kids are spending on clothing relative to a mom, dad, and two kids just a generation ago, early 1970s? The answer is they're spending 22% less in inflation-adjusted dollars than they did a generation ago. Okay, let's turn to food. You know, today's family eats out. They buy designer water. They do a lot of things that the families didn't do a generation ago. Mom, dad, and two kids today, including eating out, are spending 21% less on food than they spent a generation ago, that same mom, dad, and two kids with a stay-at-home mom who cooked. Look at appliances. They're spending 44% less today on appliances than they did a generation ago. They're spending less on furniture. They're spending less on floor coverings. They're spending less on tobacco. Yeah, they're spending a little more on computers, but they're not going broke over their computer expenditures. In other words, it ain't stuff that's sinking the American family. It's not overconsumption. Where are families actually spending their money? They're spending them in four basic areas. The first one is housing. Families today are spending 70% in inflation-adjusted dollars more on a mortgage than they spent a generation ago. Health insurance. Families today are spending 69% more on health insurance than they spent a generation ago, and now they have two more new expenses. With mom at work, families today will have two cars at the median rather than one, and paying for that second car is taking a big bite out of the budget. And the fourth one is with both parents at work, they're spending a lot more on daycare. So here's the bottom line when you add it all up. When families today, mom, dad, and two kids, make the mortgage payment, the health insurance payment, a second car for mom to get to work, and daycare or after-school care for their child, that family today has less money to spend than their parents had a generation ago. You're right. Families are running out money on credit cards. There's no doubt about it. The data are unmistakable on this. But you know why they're doing it? They're borrowing to try to make ends meet.
But here's where the problem is. Go ahead, Nicholas.
Let me just make this brief. In essence, what you're saying, though, is it is, in some sense, an exuberance of overspending, because if the house is bigger and if there's another parent working and they need another car, they don't need to do all those things. You could live in a smaller house. You could not work. I've seen studies where they took families with two working parents and they basically made them a budget with only one parent. And you're right. It's in the desire and the need to have bigger, better, more money, larger things. They're basically killing themselves. It doesn't work out properly, I guess.
Well, Nicholas, let's go back, though. I'm still going to argue with you on this one. I hear your point. I think we both agree that health insurance probably doesn't fall in that category.
Sure.
So we'll both agree to that one. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem on housing. Everyone likes to look at the McMansions, right, being built out at the edges. But it turns out for the median income family, I'm not talking about for the top 10%. I'm talking about right in the middle. Mm-hmm. The median income family has gone from a house that is 5.8 rooms to 6.3 rooms. That's how much they've increased in 30 years. But their mortgage payments have increased by 70% in inflation-adjusted dollars. So they got a little bit more room, and they got a whole lot more mortgage. They're more than twice as likely to be living in a house more than 25 years old. They're not buying new houses, and they're not buying bigger houses. Let me tell you what I think they're buying and why they're spending so much on it. Mm-hmm. They're trying to buy schools. The public school system has failed middle-class families, especially anywhere near metropolitan areas. And so unlike a family a generation ago who could buy a house based on what they thought they could afford and then send the kids to the school down the street and count on everything working out, today's families shop school district, school district, school district. And the problem is they're paying a real premium for that. Here's a place where you work out ahead, Nicholas. It turns out that cost in housing has risen more than twice as fast for families with children as for households with no children. They shop in a much narrower range of housing, and the prices are being driven up because of those school districts.
Sure.
And I have a hard time giving parents, you know, wagging my finger at parents for saying, look, you bought a six-room house in a better school district, and you're
right.
paying a huge price for it.
Nicholas, I suspect we could go back and forth on this for a while, but
sure.
let's move on. I appreciate the phone call.
Thanks for having me.
Here's an email question we got from Marie Johnson in Minneapolis. My husband and I bought our first house about a year ago. Our credit card debt has since climbed to about $60,000. I've been looking into credit counseling programs where we would send a nonprofit organization a check each month, and they pay our creditors. My husband says this kind of approach will hurt our credit rating too much. Is this a viable option, or should I look at other options instead?
Oh, I have to tell you, the first word that comes to mind right now when you say credit counseling is yikes. There are some good credit counselors out there, but this is one of those where there are sharks in the water on credit counseling. And here's the really scary part. They hold themselves out as being nonprofit. And what they really do is they rip off people who are already in financial trouble. They get them to send the checks in. They take a huge bite out of it. They pay only a little bit onto the creditors, and people's credit rating is ruined nonetheless. If you're thinking about credit counseling, you've really got to shop hard on dealing with a reliable credit counselor. And I have to say, I wish it were otherwise. I'm not at all clear how you're for certain and for sure that you've got someone who's reliable. I really want to make that point before you step out into the question about credit counseling. Will credit counseling itself ruin your credit rating? I got to tell you, it may hurt, but it depends on what you accomplish through the credit counseling. If you ultimately get your bills under control and paid off, then ultimately it will help you. Credit counseling itself is not likely to make a big difference on your credit score. What makes the big difference is how much debt you're carrying and whether or not you're falling behind on it. That's where your credit rating is really going to be affected.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Warren of the Harvard University Law School, an expert on bankruptcy, also the author of The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, or you can email us, totn@npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And now let's focus a little bit more on credit cards. Joining us now is David Lander, a bankruptcy attorney who specializes in consumer debt. He's with us from his office in St. Louis, Missouri, and good of you to join us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Why is it so easy for people to get in over their heads with credit cards?
It's so easy for a number of reasons. It starts with the advertising and the consumer culture that we're all in. That's one piece of it. A second piece is exactly what Professor Warren has been saying, is that the credit cards have actually become our safety net. An extraordinarily expensive safety net, but the economy of the situation has evolved so that it's an extraordinarily profitable product for creditors to sell. And since it's an incredibly profitable product to sell, they're anxious to send these zillions of applications out. And they, in addition, they found ways to make profitable nearly every single kind of customer.
Well, one thing that people have been pretty much identified credit card debt as a major devil, a thing to be worked down first before anything else. Some people, though, are paying off their credit cards by refinancing the house. Is that a good idea?
That's the greatest danger, I think, that nobody's talking about. Is if you have too much credit card debt, it's a bad thing, but perhaps you can go through a bankruptcy. if they sue you, there isn't all that much they can do. Perhaps they can get a judgment and garnish in some states, but not all. But the worry today is that in the last couple of years, the biggest increase has not been in credit card debt, but it's been in transferring the credit card debt to the mortgage. And what that does is it puts at risk the house. Now, the thing is, we have historically unbelievably low interest rates.
At the moment.
And they mask an enormous problem in the future. The last couple of years, even the FDIC seems worried about this, that there's been a faster growth in the amount of credit card debt that's being put onto mortgages than any other kind of borrowing. And therefore, what that means is when, not if, but when interest rates go up on mortgages, then the amount of dollars necessary to service the mortgage debt is going to go up enormously, and we may well have a crisis of foreclosures. The gentleman earlier indicated that we've got a lot of foreclosures now. We ain't seen nothing yet.
Now, how much credit card debt is too much credit card debt?
Well, you know, the FDIC just had a roundtable on that, and they invited a sort of an economist who does a lot of work for the banks. They invited a very good reporter and two others, and they didn't seem that worried in that roundtable among four people. But the truth is, nobody knows. The FDIC, in its role as regulator of banks, has been raising this issue. Of course, they raise it from the point of view of what is the risk factor to the credit card debt in the bank's portfolios.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just beginning to look at this issue, and the answer they give is really essentially nobody knows, because they've labeled what's happened the last 2 years as the consumer credit revolution, not change, but the consumer credit revolution. And as you know, after a revolution, all the rules change.
And sometimes a few heads roll.
Exactly right, and we don't know who's. Unfortunately, I'm afraid it's going to be the heads of lots of consumers who, inch by inch, got a lot of credit card debt, and then thinking they'd get tax benefits and other benefits and a lower interest rate put on their mortgage, and then when the interest rates went up, the mortgages were foreclosed upon.
We just have a few seconds left, but what about credit ratings? Credit card companies refer to those, and we all have them. Are those designed to protect us?
The credit risk scoring has actually been one of the things, the enormous development in technology and allowing in concentration. A few years ago, 20 creditors had 50% of the credit card debt. Now five of them have 70%. They've invested enormous amounts in technology, and they can now take your credit score and they can then, because other changes in the rules, they can chart. There's no limits on interest rates any longer, so they can come up with a very high interest rate that will still entice you to borrow since nothing else is available, and they can make money on you even if there's 20% default.
David Lander, thanks very much.
Thank you.
David Lander, a bankruptcy attorney. He specializes in consumer debt, and he joined us from his office in St. Louis, Missouri. When we come back from the break, we're going to wrap up our conversation with Elizabeth Warren about the crushing, in many cases, burden of family debt. Bankruptcy, what to do about it, 800-989-8255. If somebody's been through bankruptcy, give us a call. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about why so many middle-class Americans are filing for bankruptcy and what that means for families, the economy, and for corporations. Our guest is Elizabeth Warren, a professor of bankruptcy law at Harvard University's Law School. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Melissa, who's with us from Sacramento, California.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the different guests that you've had on. I'm going to go back to something that was said that actually caused me to call, and that was about the debt that's there for middle class. I'm a high-wage earner in the technology industry, became injured, used all my savings, and had to file Chapter 7 and then Chapter 13 within the past few months to save my home. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. So,
did it work?
It's working. It's working. It saves, my home increased by over $100,000 in the year and a half I've owned it. And that was my reason for doing it.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth,
I was going to lose that.
Elizabeth Warren, I think you can hear it in Melissa's voice as well as her words. This decision to file bankruptcy is tremendously emotional.
You know,
A lot of people today say bankruptcy has become too easy, and families are willing to just take bankruptcy as a first resort when they get into any kind of financial trouble. We interviewed more than 2,000 families for the study that we did for our new book, The Two Income Trap, and we discovered that most of the families were like Melissa. They said this was the hardest thing they had ever done. We talked to soldiers and police officers and teachers who said they cried when they stood there in court, that declaring yourself a public failure financially is one of the hardest things for an American to do. And that's what bankruptcy requires.
Melissa?
Yes, but getting there is part of the process. So you struggle with everything that you have, you use all of your savings, you take care of everything that you can take care of, and it was an absolute last resort. It was so much not what I wanted to do. But if you take the emotion out of it and look at what you can lose, that's where I went forward. And fortunately, I had some good attorneys that helped me get through it.
Well, Melissa, we wish you the best of luck, and I certainly hope your health gets better.
Oh, I do. Thank you.
Okay.
And Melissa really is like millions of families who've declared bankruptcy in the last few years. It's part of the healing process. It's part of the road back to recovery to keep these families in the middle class, to keep them working at their jobs instead of feeling trapped in debt for the rest of their lives.
What if people find themselves suddenly in Melissa's situation? Is there a basic amount that a family needs to squirrel away to protect themselves in case somebody loses their job, somebody gets sick?
Yeah, what we talk about in the two-income trap, we lay out financial advice for two kinds of families. Families already in financial crisis, and we walk through a little bit about bankruptcy and debt collection and so on. But for families not in financial crisis, we really emphasize in this book the importance of having a financial fire drill, of working through the options on what would happen if you lost a job, what would happen if somebody got too sick to go to work, what would happen if one of the kids or if grandma broke a hip and was sick enough that someone had to stay with them. Do you really have an emergency escape plan? You know, far too much about financial planning is about don't buy too many things at the mall, don't drink too many lattes. It's not the pennies that drown Americans. It's these big catastrophes and how to plan for them and develop escape routes if you get into financial trouble is really going to be the key to survival over the next 10 years.
Elizabeth Warren, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth Warren, a professor of bankruptcy law at Harvard Law School, the author of The Two Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. She joined us from Pacific Palisades in California.